Now, shall we begin?
One of the things that we were just discussing, and I was back with the board, and I said, and the question was asked because they've had a hard time. Police forces throughout the country have had a hard time. A lot of people killed. A lot of people killed violently, sitting in a car, waiting, sitting in a car, watching, and somebody comes from behind. And I said that one of the first things I do in terms of executive order, if I win, will be to sign a strong, strong statement that will go out to the country, out to the world, that anybody killing a policeman, policewoman, police officer, anybody killing a police officer, death penalty. It's going to happen, okay? Can't go. We can't let this go. We can't let this go.
Apparently, the best way to support your local police and keep them independent is to elect a president who would impose the death penalty by executive decree upon anybody who kills a police officer. Bear in mind, we're not talking about somebody who has been convicted of murdering a police officer, or somebody who has been even accused of criminal homicide involving a police officer. We're talking about anybody who kills a police officer, including killings that occur in the context of legitimate and unmistakable self-defense. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump received the endorsement of a New England union that represents police and corrections officers Thursday evening, that would have been December 10th, and said that as president he would call for the death penalty of any person who kills a cop, reports the Associated Press, correctly noting that Trump called for the death penalty as punishment for killing a cop, not murdering a cop. Not all acts of homicide are murders, I pointed out. The endorsement from the New England Police Benevolent Association comes as Trump remains under scrutiny for his call to ban Muslims from entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on, in Trump's formulation. The proposal has been panned as xenophobic and un-American by many of Trump's rivals, Republican leaders, and others around the world. Executive board members who attended a closed-door meeting to cast their votes said that Trump's comments had come up briefly in their discussion, but they said that most of the conversation centered on his past comments in support of the police. Consider for just a second how that conversation would have gone if the members of this police union's controlling board took the Constitution seriously, as we are incessantly told that local police do by people who are part of the Support Your Local Police movement. Somebody in this room, upon hearing Donald Trump's promise to impose the death penalty by executive fiat, should have had the presence of mind and minimal respect for the rule of law necessary to point out that a president does not have the authority to make law. Trump was also the only invited candidate to show up to the meeting, said Jerry Flynn, the NEPBA's executive director. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush also responded to their invitation, but he was unable to attend. Listen, our message very clear. It's what is the next president of the United States going to do to unite this country in an effort to save police officers? Because it's open season on police officers, Flynn said before the vote. This, of course, refers to the entirely fabricated notion of a war on police. There are fewer police officers who have been killed in the line of duty this year than there were last year. In 2014, there were slightly more line-of-duty deaths, violent line-of-duty deaths of police officers than there had been in 2013, but that's only because 2013 was the safest year, by that metric, of any in the last 50 years. There is no open season on police officers, apart from whistleblowers, that is to say, people who cross the blue line, people who apostatized from the exalted brotherhood of state-sanctioned coercion. However you want to characterize these people, if they act in defiance of the dictates of tribal loyalty on behalf of the rule of law and the rights of the public, those police officers find themselves with the proverbial target painted on their chests. Other than that, Law enforcement is one of the safest occupations of any public consequence in the United States. If you're interested in talking to somebody who runs risks to serve the public, talk to a roofer. Talk to a pizza delivery man. Talk to somebody who's in private security. Somebody who actually, by way of contract, agrees to risk his life and health and safety in defense of persons and property and does so without qualified immunity. Those people face far greater occupational risks than do police officers. People in law enforcement do not protect persons and property, and they face much lower occupational risks than people who are in the private sector who provide that actual service. At this point, those of us who are supportive of any party have to look at what is the best interest of our members, added Mr. Flynn, the New York Police Union honcho. The union represents nearly 5,000 members from about 200 locals across the region, according to Flynn, but has not received much attention from candidates campaigning in the early voting state. Trump, who spoke to gathered members and reporters before and after the endorsement was announced, stressed his support for police officers in his remarks. "Police forces throughout the country have had a hard time. A lot of people killed," said Trump, his voice still hoarse from a bout of laryngitis. He went on to call for the death penalty for any person who kills a cop. It is impossible to overemphasize the importance of that formulation. One thing I find quite interesting is that Indiana, the state of Indiana, which is a fairly significant state in the Republican presidential primaries, the state of Indiana is very congenial to Donald Trump. If I'm not mistaken, he's probably the most popular of the Republican presidential candidates in the state of Indiana. Just a couple of years ago, the state of Indiana, in a fit of common sense, overcoming the hysterical resistance of police unions, enacted a measure that recognizes the right of a citizen to kill a police officer in self-defense. The state of Indiana expanded the Castle Doctrine to include lawless acts by police officers as well as lawless acts by members of the general public. In other words, in the state of Indiana, if your life is threatened without cause by a police officer and you kill that police officer, that's an act of justifiable homicide. That's something that Donald Trump's prospective executive order would repeal. By federal decree, by presidential fiat, Donald Trump would make an Indiana resident liable to the death penalty if he killed a police officer in self-defense. This is what he said specifically. "I said that one of the first things I'd do in terms of executive order if I win will be to sign a strong, strong statement that will go out to the country, out to the world, that anybody killing policemen, policewoman, police officer, anybody killing a police officer, death penalty is going to happen, okay?" he recounted telling the executive board. He went into the board meeting looking for a presidential endorsement, and he essentially made them a campaign promise. "If you help me get elected, when I'm president, I will issue a proclamation mandating the death penalty for anybody who kills a police officer, including people who do so in self-defense. That apparently is the best way to support your local police, at least in the eyes of the neo-fascists who support Donald Trump." This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Stand by for more sedition after this.
We see this morning the Obama administration, in an executive order, come out and say they're not going to send certain military equipment any longer to local police. Now, libertarians will see that as a victory, but the people on the streets will not. You see, you've got to put yourself in the position of a local policeman. We as well have been concerned about the influx of military equipment into our local community from the federal government due to the strings that are attached to it. But nonetheless, if you put yourself in the shoes of a policeman today, what's coming down the road, what's been happening recently, necessitates much of this equipment, whether you like it or not. And believe me, the difference between law enforcement in the 1960s and law enforcement today is radically different. The police are forced to do things they could not nor would do in the 1960s that infuriate the local citizenry. But that is up to the legislature, not up to the local police. They are simply enforcing the law. Take your grievance up with the legislature. Take your grievance up with the Congress. But in the drug situation that we see today, in the militancy of cartels that are attached to drugs, with a rising militancy of communist cadres within the inner cities, whipping up people into the streets to do harm to the police, they need equipment that will protect them in the performance of their duties. Whether we like it or not, it isn't the equipment itself. It's the strings that come with the equipment that we don't like. We have to support our local police, regardless of what you think of them.
In Baltimore and Chicago, and these are some tough dudes. They're going to be out so fast. One of the first things I'm going to do is get rid of those gang members. We are going to get rid of those gang members so fast your head will spin.
Trump asserted Baltimore police were hamstrung by city officials during the riots.
I mean, they allowed, in one night, that first night in Baltimore, they allowed that city to be destroyed. They set it back 35 years, one night, because the police were not allowed to protect people.
Trump noted the importance of allowing police to perform their duties unfettered by the demands of anti-cop activists.
But we need law and order. We need our police. They're great people. They do a phenomenal job. They're right now afraid to do anything. They're afraid. I mean, I know cities. I won't mention names, but I know cities where police are afraid to even talk to people because they want to be able to retire and have their pension. They don't want to be thrown off the police force.
Shamelessly pandering to one of the most petulant and pampered public employee unions in the country, Donald Trump promised that if elected president, one of the first things he would do would be to sign an executive proclamation mandating the death penalty for anybody who kills, not murders, but kills a police officer. In its report on that speech in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the Associated Press notes that while there is currently a federal death penalty, states have their own laws on capital punishment, and governors and legislatures have the authority to decide what those statutes look like independent of a presidential executive order. In states that have the death penalty, killing a police officer is often already considered an aggravating factor in deciding whether a defendant will be eligible for capital punishment. In other words, we have yet another illustration of the fact that Donald Trump doesn't understand the Constitution and really doesn't care what the Constitution says. And those who support him meet that description as well. And among his most impassioned supporters are police officers, who supposedly are there in order to protect our rights, as guaranteed, supposedly once again, by the Constitution. Trump also expressed support for local police departments using military equipment, which the Obama administration has worked to curb following complaints about officers using riot gear and armored vehicles to confront protesters in Ferguson, Missouri. I should point out that although the aftermath of the rioting in Ferguson, Missouri offered probably the most lurid display of police militarization, that's by no means the most objectionable facet of that phenomenon. The quotidian militarization of the police, displayed by between 80 and 120 daily SWAT raids, is a far greater source of concern than overreaction in the face of urban unrest. "You know they're taking away the military equipment," said Trump. "Every time I see a conflict, I see a van pull up, I see an armor-plated Humvee pull up, I see almost a tank in some cases pull up. We've got to let our police have the finest equipment and the finest training, and if we don't," he said, "we're making a tremendous mistake as a country." Once again, here's somebody who knows nothing about the issue, but pontificates about it as if he knew everything about the issue. But the point is, he has almost an instinctive ability to understand exactly what it is that people of an authoritarian disposition want to hear. They want to hear him talk about strength. They want to hear him say that we need to be vigilant and strong and smart, and couple that with some repudiation of the idea that there should be any limits on what government can do in order to achieve what it is that Donald Trump thinks should be done. A really good example of this is his signature proposal to build a wall, a great big beautiful wall, on the southern border of the United States, as if free countries erect walls at their borders. He has said that he would make Mexico pay for this, supposedly by applying the trade surplus that Mexico has to the construction of the wall. It's clear that he doesn't understand what a trade surplus is. He seems to think, or at least he wants to convey the impression that he thinks, that there is $500 billion sitting around in Mexico City somewhere that could be confiscated and applied to the construction of a wall on the southern border of the United States with Mexico. On another occasion, he suggested that he would simply confiscate money that is being remitted to Mexico by workers here in the United States, which is to say, as a commentator at Reason magazine has pointed out, Donald Trump wants to turn the United States into a fully realized kleptocracy, simply stealing money that has been earned as it's being transmitted through the banking system into Mexico. The people who support Donald Trump for reasons of pure reptilian brain instinct haven't really thought through the mechanics of what it is he proposes to do and the type of powers he would have to arrogate to himself in order to accomplish his objectives. Because there's a simple visceral thrill in associating yourself with somebody who brazenly and unflinchingly talks about asserting power at the expense of people you despise. Among the people who would be liable to the death penalty if Donald Trump were elected president and if he could somehow impose his will by executive decree would be a man by the name of Henry McGee from Texas. In December of 2013, McGee was rudely awakened in his bedroom at about 5:30 in the morning by armed intruders whom he didn't recognize and who did not bother to identify themselves. Knowing only that he and his family confronted a mortal risk, McGee grabbed a gun and opened fire, and in doing so he fatally wounded Sergeant Adam Soders, who was part of a local narcotics task force carrying out a no-knock warrant in search of drugs. This happens every single day in this country, dozens or scores of times. McGee was arrested, he was charged with murder, and in February of 2014, a grand jury in Burleson County, Texas, declined to indict McGee. They returned what's called a no bill, because they accepted his claim that he acted in self-defense in the belief that his home was being burglarized, which actually is a good description. They were looking for something they could use to justify seizing everything in the home. Those are the incentives behind the militarization of law enforcement that so enchants Donald Trump. I have on several occasions quoted from Lysander Spooner, who was an abolitionist and what we would now call a libertarian or perhaps even an anarchist, and one of the most perspicuous critics of the United States Constitution as a document that actually extends the power of the state over the individual. Having a properly cynical perspective on the Constitution, he did appreciate some of its provisions. "The constitutional security for the right to keep and bear arms implies the right to use them," wrote Lysander Spooner in his essay, The Right of Resistance. "This is the only remedy suggested by the Constitution and is necessarily the only remedy that can exist when the government becomes so corrupt as to afford no peaceable one. The people have a legal right to resort to this remedy at all times when the government goes beyond or contrary to the Constitution, and it is only a matter of discretion with them whether to resort to it at any particular time." The whole point of the Second Amendment is to protect the right of citizens to kill police officers when police officers violate their rights and threaten their lives. Donald Trump has earned a lot of support among gun rights advocates because he proposes a national right to carry law. The problem is, by virtue of his presidential decree, he would effectively abolish the Second Amendment by criminalizing the purpose of its existence. I'll be back in just a minute.
Okay, I'm gonna rise up, gonna kick a little ass, gonna kick some ass in the USA, gonna climb a mountain, gonna sew a flag, gonna fly on an eagle, I'm gonna kick some butt, I'm gonna drive a big truck, I'm gonna rule this world, I'm gonna kick some ass, I'm gonna rise up, I'm gonna kick a little ass, rock flag and eagle!
So does it happen a lot? Government commandeering your ship, telling you where to go?
That's what governments are for, getting a man's way.
Back in March of 2012, when the Indiana State Legislature approved Senate Bill 1, Representative Linda Lawson, a former police officer as it happens, lamented that if that measure were enacted, it would signal, here it comes, open season on law enforcement. You have men and women in your community who are willing to die for you, willing to die for your family, insisted Lawson, speaking on behalf of 15 members of the state's police union. The only suitable way for mundanes to express proper gratitude to the heroic paladins of public order, she insisted, was to protect their supposed authority to invade your home and kill you with impunity. And that is a privilege that would be fatally undermined by SB 1. That measure was passed by the legislature and signed into law, and in the 2 years that it has been in effect, we have not seen a great surge in fatal attacks on law enforcement. Perhaps because the enactment of that bill had a moderating influence on the conduct of police officers who might otherwise be throwing their weight around a little bit more promiscuously than they have. Welcome back, by the way, to Freedom Zealot Radio. I'm William Grigg. In addition to producing this broadcast, I am the author and the proprietor of the Pro Libertate blog. You can find that at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal button at the bottom of every essay. There's one at the right-hand margin of the page. There's also a Bitcoin button. I would really appreciate any help you could provide. The text of Senate Bill 1, this measure that was supposedly so pregnant with awfulness, stated that its legislative purpose was, quote, to protect citizens from unlawful entry into their homes by law enforcement officers or persons pretending to be law enforcement officers. Both citizens and law enforcement officers benefit from clear guidance about the parameters of lawful home entry, which will reduce the potential for violence and respect the privacy and property of citizens. To that end, the bill recognized that an individual, quote, may use force to prevent or terminate a law enforcement officer's unlawful entry. That is now the law of the land in the state of Indiana, which anomalously has a very large constituency for Donald Trump, who has just promised that if he is elected dictator, and no other description of his approach to the executive branch would be suitable, if he were elected dictator, one of his first acts would be to issue a presidential proclamation mandating the death penalty for anybody who, quote, kills a police officer. Lawson and others who are speaking on behalf of police unions incessantly use the hunting metaphor open season when referring to the supposed surge in violence against police officers. That is something, once again, that has not happened. It's a convenient cliche for them, but it contains a deeper significance that we shouldn't ignore. The state's exalted brotherhood of coercion assumes that the privacy of the individual's home falls within the police officer's natural habitat. In other words, it's open season on us. Those of us who demand the reciprocal respect for the right of citizens to use lethal force against police officers supposedly are declaring open season on police who see us as their natural prey. Senate Bill 1 in Indiana was not an innovation. It simply restored an explicit understanding of Indiana's Castle Doctrine, which many other states have taken, which many other states have recognized in their state statutes. That was subverted in 2011 in a ruling by the Indiana State Supreme Court in the case of Barnes versus State. In other words, you have the legislature dealing with a terrible ruling by the state Supreme Court. That ruling effectively nullified the core protections contained in the Fourth Amendment, or what we're told are the core protections of that parchment barricade, and the equivalent provision within the Indiana State Constitution, as well as protections and immunities recognized by common law dating back to the English Magna Carta of 1215, as one wire service report at the time summarized. That 3-2 decision in May of 2011 held that Indiana residents have no right to obstruct unlawful police incursions into their homes. The incident that gave rise to the Barnes ruling occurred in 2007, when police were summoned to the home of Richard Barnes and his wife by a 911 call reporting a domestic disturbance, which, of course, is something that happens altogether too often. Barnes was in the parking lot arguing with his girlfriend when the police arrived. She, the girlfriend, had already thrown a duffel bag of his belongings outside the apartment and told him to take the rest of his stuff. As Barnes re-entered the apartment to do so, the police attempted to follow him inside. He quite properly told the police officer to stay out and enforce that lawful order by shoving a police officer who disobeyed. In other words, he was dealing with an intruder, a trespasser. He was not using lethal force. He was not using aggressive force. He was using defensive force against an armed intruder. He found himself charged with battery on a police officer, resisting law enforcement, disorderly conduct, and interfering with the reporting of a crime. The trial judge rejected a proposed jury instruction that Barnes had the right to resist unlawful police entry, and Barnes was convicted on the second and third charges. Following the verdict, the Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court had committed a reversible error by rejecting the jury instruction. The state of Indiana frantically appealed to the Supreme Court, which upheld the conviction. "We believe," wrote the Supreme Court of Indiana, "a right to resist an unlawful police entry into a home is against public policy and is incompatible with modern Fourth Amendment jurisprudence," in the words of Justice Stephen David. "We also find that allowing resistance unnecessarily escalates the level of violence and therefore the risk of injuries to all parties involved without preventing the arrest." Of course, only one side has the right to escalate from the perspective of those who believe in this hideous fiction called the state. What SB 1 did in Indiana was it recognized that you have a right to escalate your use of defensive force up to and including killing a police officer who invades your property with the intent to do you harm unlawfully. I never tire of pointing out that the risks to a police officer in these encounters are generally vanishingly small. But we shouldn't forget that at all times and in all places, officer safety is the controlling priority of authoritarians. It's not surprising that the court would say there's no right to beat the hell out of the officer, commented legal analyst Ivan Bodensteiner. When a cop invades a home without legal authority, he is acting like a criminal rather than a peace officer, and the Indiana law recognizes that principle by focusing on the act of illegal entry rather than the identity of the aggressor. I think we must not forget that we're dealing with a species of identity politics here. In this case, the identity is defined by occupation, not by ethnicity or by religion. The Indiana measure allows for forcible entry only when the officer has a valid warrant or legitimate probable cause, is in pursuit of a criminal suspect, or is acting with the consent or on the invitation of an adult resident. In other words, all it did was restore the status quo ante the Barnes ruling, which, in nullifying the Fourth Amendment, actually issued a hunting license to the police. I'll be back in just a minute.
Father, will MacGregors ever be kings again?
All men with honor are kings. But not all kings have honor.
What is honor?
Honor is what no man can give you, and none can take away. Honor is a man's gift to himself.
Do women have it?
Women are the heart of honor, and we cherish and protect it in them. You must never mistreat a woman or malign a man, nor stand by and see another do so.
How do you know if you have it?
Never worry on the getting of it. It grows in you and speaks to you. All you need do is listen.
Began as a routine traffic stop. It ended with the avoidable shooting death of a young man that the killer described as an act of self-defense. After the jury acquitted the defendant of murder, the prosecutor indicted the shooter a second time on several lesser charges. The second jury acquitted the defendant on the most serious charges and deadlocked regarding multiple counts of assault with a deadly weapon. This time, the prosecutor, grudgingly admitting that the defendant had been exonerated in a fair trial, dismissed the remaining charges. The shooter in this incident would be subject to the death penalty under the scheme that Donald Trump is proposing. His name was Saigon Penn. He was 22 years old, living in San Diego, when he was detained and assaulted by officers Donovan Jacobs and Thomas Riggs in March of 1985. Ironically enough, at the time, Saigon Penn was about 2 weeks away from starting a job as a police officer himself. He had been accepted to be a community service officer with the San Diego Police Department. He had also filled out an application to attend the police academy. Both in physical and temperamental terms, Penn was manifestly overqualified for a job in law enforcement. He hadn't played high school sports, but he was tall and athletic, and he had earned a brown belt in karate. According to his friends and family, he was a natural peacemaker by disposition. He was a student of Buddhism who later converted to Christianity, and who learned martial arts as a way to protect himself and those around him without using lethal force. This is somebody who, by way of disposition, was geared toward de-escalation. Officer Jacobs, by way of contrast, was superbly qualified to be a law enforcer and patently unqualified to be a peace officer and manifestly unsuitable for civilized company. He was described as, quote, one of the most prejudiced white people I've ever known and an ideal candidate for the Ku Klux Klan by a former police colleague named Drew McIntyre, who became a minister in nearby Alpine, California, after he had left the San Diego Police Department in disgust. Fellow San Diego police officer Nathaniel Jordan, a black man who also left law enforcement for the ministry, confirmed the assessment offered by Mr. McIntyre, testifying that Jacobs made casual and frequent use of epithets in his presence, such as nigger and boy. During Penn's second trial, former San Diego Police Department Lieutenant Doyle Wheeler described his attempts to warn supervisors that Jacobs' bigotry and aggression had provoked confrontations endangering the lives of his comrades. Jacobs was made a police agent, that's the department's official designation for patrol officers, despite an academy assessment documenting his tendency to use profanity, slurs, and lies in his police work, in the words of a Los Angeles Times summary of the evidence presented at trial. Unless you show some considerable change or at least some more consideration for others and can change your behavior, we don't want you because you are going to do nothing but create problems for yourself, for the public, and for the department, Jacobs was told by an academy supervisor in 1979, about 6 years before his fatal encounter with Sagon Penn. At the time of that confrontation, Jacobs was a known danger to his colleagues and to the public at large. Mr. Penn, despite rumors that the prosecution lusted to introduce as evidence in the subsequent trial, had no criminal record, no gang affiliations, and no demonstrated inclination toward violence. Among the tenets instilled in Sagon Penn by his karate sensei, Ornid Gabriel, was the need to de-escalate conflicts before they could take root and flourish into violence. Self-defense, as Penn was taught, begins with walking away from a potential fight, which of course is something you cannot do once you've come to the attention of a police officer. You're considered to be his property from the moment that the police officer directs his gaze in your direction. Officer Jacobs, who had stopped Penn without cause simply because he was a young black man in the company of several black friends, was determined to start a fight. Penn, on the other hand, was determined to avoid one if at all possible. He wasn't stopped for a traffic violation. The official pretext supplied in the subsequent report was that he had made an illegal U-turn, but that pretense dissolved very quickly during the first trial. He was seated behind the wheel of a pickup truck in a driveway talking with friends when Jacobs inflicted himself upon him. "Are you blood or cuz?" Jacobs sneered at Penn, assuming that the puzzled young black man simply had to be a member of a street gang. "Are you blood or cuz?" Although Jacobs had neither probable cause nor reasonable suspicion to do so, he demanded identification from Penn. Out of an abundance of caution and once again a desire to be fully cooperative, Penn handed the officer his billfold, inviting him to inspect its contents. His intent, Penn later explained, was to demonstrate that there were no drugs or anything in there. Jacobs, who by this time was being backed up by Officer Thomas Riggs, who arrived in a separate cruiser with a police groupie named Serapina, reciprocated his cooperation by shoving the wallet back in Penn's face and ordering him to withdraw his license. Recognizing that Jacobs was trying to start a fight rather than to conduct a legitimate investigation, Penn behaved in accordance with his martial arts training. He put up his hands in a gesture of withdrawal and walked away, as he had every right to do, because this was not a legitimate investigative stop. At this point, he'd done everything that the law required. He was not legally obliged to answer any questions or to endure any abuse. He had been compliant and respectful in the face of provocation, and rather than responding with violence, when baited by Jacobs, he stood down. These actions, according to San Diego Deputy DA Michael Carpenter, displayed an insurmountable attitude problem toward authority. The unarmed Penn, whom Carpenter described as Mr. Arrogance, supposedly threatened officers Jacobs and Riggs by asserting his legal right to end a conversation with a truculent, abusive cop. His behavior was insolent, brazen, and immature in dealing with the police officer who supposedly had the authority to berate him in any language he chose and detain him on a whim, according to Carpenter. After Penn turned to leave, Jacobs attacked him from behind, throwing him to the ground and assaulting him with both punches and kicks. "He beat me down over and over," Penn would later recall. "He beat me down. He beat me down." Unprepared for the skill with which the trained and physically capable victim repelled the unprovoked attack, the costumed bully withdrew his baton and, according to several witnesses, screamed that he was going to beat your black ass. Rather than intervene on behalf of the victim, Officer Riggs joined in the criminal assault. I could hear him just grunting with anger and just breathing real hard and just trying to take my head off, Penn later recounted to investigators. At the time, Jacobs was sitting on top of me, punching me in the face. He was reaching for his gun. He was reaching, like, right there for his gun, and I reached and I grabbed it before he did. The power of the state was ganging up on him, summarized defense attorney Milton Silverman during Penn's second trial. Multiple witnesses described how, after he gained control of Jacob's gun, the victim hesitated and briefly pleaded for the assailants to stop before firing several shots within the space of 6 seconds. Riggs was fatally wounded. Sarah Pena, who was sitting in a police vehicle, suffered a gunshot wound that left her paralyzed. Jacobs, who had instigated the entire affair, was shot in his right arm and then run over by Penn, who commandeered a police vehicle and fled, not from the police, but to the police, acting entirely out of character for someone who supposedly had an insurmountable problem with authority. Penn drove to the nearest police station to report the incident. "The police were nice to me at first," Penn told a reporter following a second trial, "but that didn't last." He was acquitted in both trials. And during an interview that took place with investigators following the second trial, for the purpose of determining whether there was going to be a lawsuit filed against him, Sagan Penn actually broke down weeping. "I should have just gone ahead and let him blow my head off," Penn tearfully told investigators following his acquittal. "Lord, is that what you want? You know, that's a tough faith, but at the same time, it's like saying, well, Lord, if that's your will, then I'll just close my eyes and just pray. That's what I would do right now. If it ever happened again like that, I would just close my eyes and I would just pray. I'll just accept that pain. I'll just accept that bullet to my head." Penn was haunted by the fact that Officer Riggs had a family. "I would cry. I couldn't live. I hated holidays. I'll always be worrying and praying and thinking about his 2 children and crying." Penn succumbed to severe depression and drug abuse. This led to subsequent run-ins with the police, owing to his erratic behavior. As his emotional condition deteriorated, he became suicidal, and on Independence Day of 2002, he took his own life, thereby consummating by his own hand the fate that Jacobs and many of the officer's comrades had intended for him. When informed of Penn's demise, Bill Farrar, the president of the local police union, reacted with all of the graciousness that we have come to expect from people in his position. "As far as the Police Officers Association is concerned, the world is better off without him," sneered Farrar. That's because that Sagan Penn dared to act like a man invested with the right to defend himself against the criminal violence of somebody accoutred in the habiliments of the state's punitive priesthood. If Sagan Penn had done this under the reign of Donald Trump, he would have been executed by presidential decree. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week. And until then, as always, dum spirito pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight him until we can't.